Welcome to Running Off the Rails. My name is Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And today, we'll be tackling sentient magic items in Dungeons & Dragons. We will take a look at some of the most compelling sentient magic items in popular culture and compare them to some of the items available in D&D. We only have a short window to record today, so we're going to skip our life update.
Most magic items that we come across in D&D are non-sentient. This means they're primarily tools, they have no motives, and no way of imposing their own wants or needs on the bearer or the world. In D&D, we typically use the term sentient to describe any magic item that can both speak and has a personality. But there is a broad spectrum of choices to be made when designing the personality of a sentient magic item that you intend for a player to carry.
We took a look at some of the most compelling sentient magic items in popular culture, and we were able to organize them into three separate categories of sentient magic item. The first category is sapient, magic items that typically contain the soul or spirit of something that was once human and is able to speak and think with human context. The next category is awakened. These are items that can speak and are intelligent, but they are not sapient. They are not human. So even though they have motives and goals, the ways that they go about them can sometimes seem very extreme or single-minded to their human carriers. And the third type of magic item, my favorite type of sentient magic item, is alien. These items cannot speak to their bearers or their carriers. They act on the world in order to try and achieve their motivations or their goals, and it is left up to the players to try and interpret what those goals and those motivations are based on the actions of the item. They cannot ask the item, "What do you want?" And the item cannot answer.
We hope that by deconstructing the traits of these magic items, like Nightblood from the Stormlight Archives or the One Ring from Lord of the Ring, that we can arm listeners with the building blocks to design compelling and wonder-inducing sentient magic items for their own games.
So type 1, sapient. The first category of sentient magic item that we'll look at is the sapient magic item. These are sentient magic items that have humanity or human context. They are typically items that bear the souls of people who once lived, but now their consciousness resides within the magic item. An example of a magic item like this from Dungeons & Dragons is the Black Staff. The mechanics block of the Black Staff reads thusly. Personality. The staff has the spirit of all previous Black Staffs trapped within. Its creator, Kelben Aronson, is the dominant personality among them. Like Kelben, the staff is extremely devious and manipulative. It prefers to counsel its owner without exerting outright control. The staff's primary goal is to protect Waterdeep and its open lord. Its secondary goal is to help its wielder become more powerful. In the event that the holder of office of the Black Staff no longer serves the staff's wishes, the staff ceases to function until it finds a worthy inheritor, someone whose loyalty to Waterdeep is beyond reproach. After reading this item description, I have a few observations. The first is that the item, the Black Staff, can turn its own powers off if it decides that the person who's carrying it is not worthy. And that's a really interesting thing for a magic item to do. I think it's actually pretty typical of sapient and sometimes even awakened magic items that when the user is not acting in the interest of the magic item, that it turns off its powers to that user. And that's a really interesting mechanic.
This is somewhat reminiscent to me about the mechanics for paladins breaking their oath. In both cases, if your player is not behaving in the way that the world wants them to, there are serious consequences to their abilities. In the case of a paladin, you are encouraged as a GM to maybe make them choose another class, in the same way that if they're not working well with the sapient weapon, they must choose a different magical weapon, or the weapon chooses a different owner. And personally, I also use these types of mechanics with clerics sometimes, and I've seen this in multiple actual plays, that if the cleric is not acting in the best interests of their deity, or maybe a warlock is not acting in the best interests of their patron, they can lose some power in their day-to-day abilities. Thinking of this sapient magic weapon as a type of patron in some ways, I think is a pretty classic way to show the motivation and make your magic weapon very real and very interesting to your players.
I think that this can be a feature, or it can be a bug. I think that when we imagine the super cool, super rare magic item that our players will eventually find and that they'll eventually become known for, or maybe they'll become synonymous, right? Like King Arthur is known for wielding the sword Excalibur. The two are bound together in legend. When we think about our players possessing this item, if the item can turn off its powers for the player that is wielding it, the item is more of a partner. It's more of a character that is choosing to lend its aid to the hero. And I think that can sometimes take away from the feeling of ownership over the item or the feeling of possessing the item that we sometimes celebrate in Dungeons & Dragons. I think that Dungeons & Dragons can be a lot about diving into a dungeon and earning a very, very powerful tool to be used in future adventures. And when you find a sentient magic item that is a fully developed person in their own right, that has morals and ideas and philosophies and goals, and the player needs to like collaborate with that partner instead of being able to wield that partner, that it can take away from some of the awesomeness of possessing an incredibly powerful magic item.
This is a delicate and I think somewhat important point about introducing sentience and even more so introducing sapience into your world. You know, we ascribe a lot of like moral value to sapient things. And I'm reminded of this somewhat weird interaction in a book where the grass has sentience and the characters find this out and they're like, oh my god, like we just step on grass. All of humanity steps on grass. We plant grass to like run all over it and tear it up. Like, are we horrible people? And then the first time they get to talk to the grass, they realize the grass like loves being stepped on and it's its favorite thing in the world. And this is a strange dynamic and is something that I think you can see come up with like awakened grass. You know, Critical Role, there's a great example of this moss that always asks for consent to before being touched. And
is that crabgrass?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's a very funny moment, but it's funny because it has this like underlying idea that, oh, if you're going to inscribe sentience to things that doesn't normally have sentience, like you now have a new set of rules you need to follow. And so if you want to give your players an amazing part of their character that is cool and that is special to them, that is very different than giving them an ally. And I think some sapient magic items do run a little bit of risk or blur this line of a tool versus an ally. And that's why I often think of these magic items as closer to being DM-run NPCs than a weapon that a player has on their character sheet.
When we think about sapient items done really, really well in popular culture, it is often a motivation of the item to return to the mortal world by possessing their possessor. One strong example of this is Tom Riddle's diary in Harry Potter. At first, the diary starts off as a bit of a mysterious item, but as it becomes more and more powerful, it is able to manifest its sapience more and more, eventually having full conversations with the protagonists. I think that the diary is an example of a sapient magic item done really well because it still retains some of the mystery and wonder that we're going to see implicit to awakened and alien items later in this episode, eventually growing into a full-on antagonist, which is definitely one of the pros of a sapient item, is because it is a character, over time, you can have it grow into a major player in the plot of your game.
The next type of magic item that we want to talk about is kind of a step further away from human sentience. We want to call it an awakened magic item. And what we mean by awakened is a magic item that can interact with the players through communication, but isn't communicating from the mind of a human. Instead, it's communicating from the perspective of that item. So a sword that communicates, but is still a sword, or a book that communicates, but is still a book. Whereas Tom Riddle's diary is a book that communicates, but it actually has the soul of a human trapped inside of it.
These items are used most effectively in stories when they are given opportunities to demonstrate just how non-human they are. When a player or an audience member first sees an item like this, I think our natural reaction is to ascribe sapience to it. Oh, this thing can think and this thing can talk. The only things that I've ever interacted with that can do that are other humans. This thing must also think and speak and operate like a human. You can use this assumption or this expectation to great dramatic effect when the item suddenly demonstrates just how non-human or just how non-sapient it actually is.
The way that this oftentimes manifests is that the item itself doesn't actually understand the complexity or the magnitude of what it wants, creating a moment of irony or humor, and in some cases, a moment of drama. There are weapons, and if really all they know, and if they were really built to be tools of war, maybe they don't understand the consequences that you might have of hurting another creature, and maybe they want to hurt an ally, which in some scenarios would be very funny, but if that magic item has a little bit more influence, it could be a moment of serious drama.
My favorite, absolute favorite example of an awakened item is Nightblood from originally Warbreaker, but then the Stormlight Archives. Nightblood is a sentient magic sword that was awakened with the command phrase, "Slay Evil." That is its purpose. It's what it was created to do. Michael Kramer gives this sword just an absolutely amazing personality and accent and way of speaking in the audiobook performances of Warbreaker and the Stormlight Archive. And I've cherry-picked some quotes from the sword, and I'm going to do my best Michael Kramer impersonation of impersonating Nightblood just to maybe get across just how awesome this character is in the books.
I'm very happy that you're doing this impression, Ray, and I'm glad that everybody else gets to hear it too.
Just some of these quotes are just so good that we can't not do our best to get this across. One of the first times we meet Nightblood, he greets the character that he is being gifted to, and he says, "Hello, would you like to destroy some evil today?" Which I think is just a hilarious way to greet a character, and just obviously gets across like what it is excited to do at all times. Like, he's always trying to persuade people to draw him and slay evil, because that is its singular purpose in existence.
Yeah, and I know that if you used that voice for a group of players at your table, they would immediately love this item. They would go crazy, because clearly you would have put a lot of love into this voice and this dialogue, and it's just really funny, and it makes the intro to this magic item an absolute hit, you know, from the get-go.
The item is used to do incredible acts of violence in the book series. Like, entire massacres are caused by this item, either corrupting people and having them wield the item against themselves and others if the item perceives them to be evil, which it itself is very challenging for it to decide what evil is, because it's a piece of steel. And it's funny because the characters will talk about the item in the item's presence. So here's another quote from Nightblood. "I'm not bloodthirsty. I just want to be useful," which is just amazing. And then there's another scene where one of the characters wields Nightblood and does one of these huge massacres, like wipes out, I think, like tens of powerful enemies in the enemy army. But it's an army, so there's many more. So the character like does a great job fighting like 50 enemies, and Nightblood is still not satisfied though, because there is still evil to be slain. So he consoles the character. He goes, "I think you did a great job, Seth. You didn't destroy many of them, yes, but you just need some more practice," which I think is hilarious because he keeps trying to persuade Zeth to draw him and practice with him more, which just even drawing this sentient magic item exacts an incredible toll on the wielder. It's interesting because one of the wielders at one point is kind of meditating on the item itself's existence, just kind of like looking at the item and thinking about the item. While it carries him, and he's thinking to himself, how was an object of steel, an object that was so removed from life that it would find the experience of living strange in alien, supposed to understand what evil was, because it was awakened with that command phrase, slay evil. And Nightblood actually cuts in to this character's internal monologue, because it communicates with its wielder telepathically, and he goes, "I'm figuring it out. I've had a lot of practice." Like, just like him killing hundreds of thousands of people in its mind is just like practicing the piano, like practicing its scales so that one day it can like perform Mozart, right? Like, one day I'll be able to slay evil because I've been practicing so diligently. Like, it doesn't understand the like moral weight of ending human life at all.
Yeah, it's such an outrageous character in the story, and I think it's a perfect example of showing what fantasy and sci-fi are such a great medium for, which is asking yourself the question, what if, and really exploring, like, what would it be like if a sword could talk? And really starting from there and building your character around that is a great way to introduce awakened magic items that are interesting and not just cookie cutter into your game. If you wanted to have a, you know, source of light that was awakened, you know, ask yourself, what would a flashlight or a torch that could communicate really think and feel? And then you can introduce into your game, you know, an everlasting torch, and it's not just a, like, thing that is in your player's pack. It's a real living and thinking thing that is a cool sentient magic item, but it's not just an NPC that your players could just have a friend with dark vision follow them around. You know, this is a tool that is specific to Dungeons and Dragons and specific to fantasy settings that is really changing your setting in a world-building style. And then in this way, you're not just adding a new character, you're actually doing world building. You're showing your players what kinds of things exist in a fantasy world.
I think that awakened magic items are really hard to pull off, though. A lot of the magic items that are presented in the Dungeon Master's Guide are awakened magic items by the definitions that we've kind of laid out. They weren't human spirits trapped within items. They are items that are crafted with such passion or such purpose that they actively want to fulfill their purpose. But I think there's a lot of ways to actually like get this wrong. A lot of the times I think we end up seeing awakened magic items that behave like sapient magic items, because it requires a lot of attention to detail to roleplay an awakened magic item different non-humanly, because we are humans. So every time you need to respond to a question or respond to something that a player has said as the magic item, you need to kind of like put yourself in that headspace again before you respond. Even more difficult, I think, from playing or role-playing a human that is very different from yourself. So like acting as someone who's very different from yourself, because you're acting as a non-human. And then another way that I've seen these items lose their kind of effect, the effect that you're going for, with having them be extremely non-human is when their goal is too abstract. And this is the problem that I see with a lot of the awakened magic items that are presented by the Dungeon Master's Guide. So Black Razor, for example, which is an item that I think could very easily be Nightblood. Like, if you wanted to drop Nightblood into your game, you could take the mechanics of Black Razor and replace the personality and sentience blocks of the mechanic with Nightblood's flavor, and it would work really well. But Black Razor's personality in the Dungeon Master's Guide is to consume souls. It doesn't care whose souls it eats, because it believes that all matter and energy sprang from a void of negative energy and will one day return to it, and it is meant to hurry that process along. And I think that that is very wordy. I think it leads to an item that acts, an awakened item that acts with a little bit too much nuance approaching sapience, even though it does have a goal, which is to consume souls. And I think that a simpler goal is more useful for creating a compelling awakened magic item.
Yeah, the DMG has this list of sentient magic items available, and there's this one called the Moonblade, which is a sword whose goal is the advancement of elvenkind. It's like the most abstract possible goal that you could make, and it's like, what is this doing in your campaign? I mean, I guess maybe you could write a whole thing around the elven society and like give your players a role to do there, but it is not a very inspiring magic item to be given as a player. Where would you go from there?
I think a magic item that does this really well in Dungeons and Dragons is the Sword of Cass. The sword's purpose is to bring ruin to Vecna, killing Vecna's worshippers, destroying the Lich's works, and foiling his machinations, all to help fulfill this goal. So here we're seeing a pattern, which is, I think that a recipe for a compelling awakened magic item that gives you a lot of freedom as a dungeon master, because I think there's a lot of freedom for comedy here and drama and an improvisation of dialogue, is keep it super simple. The recipe is verb and a noun. We see slay evil or consume souls or destroy Vecna. I like how this verb and noun creates a single-mindedness in the item that can feel obsessive and very non-sapient or very non-human. And I think that that is a good place to start from. So, Ariel, you kind of talked about an awakened torch that could be a sentient magic item. What do you think, like, a good verb and noun for this imaginary torch could be?
Putting me on the spot. Well, I think there's kind of the like more abstract, larger idea, which you could say to destroy darkness or illuminate darkness. And that might be something that I think is kind of in line with these like DMG style, a little bit more vague ideals. But I would like to move more in the direction of the style of goals that the Sword of Cass has, and would maybe try to use, you know, like a proper noun as the noun here. And so maybe I would, you know, want to say, illuminate Avernus. And now this torch's goal, it was a tool built by the gods to fight back against a specific lower plane. And so now you maybe have a lot of abilities that are very, very useful in just the dark, dangerous places in the material plane, but it does have an overarching idea that is going to push your campaign in a direction if your players follow it and if your players really engage with this sentient magic item. Like, the Sword of Cass is still a useful weapon to give your player before they are on a specific straight line path to killing Vecna. And then the goal of the sword is not in the foreground of your story immediately, but the goal is still there, and it's still present in the storytelling of your campaign. And rather than being like a vague background thing where it's just like, if you're only trying to consume souls, then for the rest of your campaign of D&D, your sword is just going to be a sword, and it's not going to feel that different than if the sword was not sentient.
Yeah, it's driving you to do something, but there's a lot of flexibility in what it's driving you to do. And what that means is there's a lot of flexibility in the personality of the sword. Like, the sword can start to have these very sophisticated arguments because it is flexible in the way that you can appease it. And I think that starts to make the sword feel more and more sapient, right? So, like, reveal darkness is useful almost everywhere, which I think just makes the item feel a little bit less specific and a little bit more like a regular torch. So I think that's a great example.
Yeah. I'm glad you put me on the spot, and I'm glad we could show in real time the process of, you know, solidifying your ideals a little bit more for these items that give them real purpose in your game. And I think that this is not limited to items that can physically speak or telepathically communicate with your players. There is a third category of magic item that we want to discuss, which are magic items that don't have the ability to communicate but are still sentient in some way.
We've dubbed the name for this category alien because they want things, they have motivations, but there is no way to communicate or collaborate or treat with the item. You cannot explain to it your motivations and try to persuade it to work with you because it cannot speak with you, it cannot hear you, it cannot understand you. All it understands is action.
This is a really interesting category, and the Dungeon Master's Guide specifically references it in a table that they have for how your sentient magic items might communicate. And the first thing in this table, which is like on a value of a D100 from 0 to 60, so it's like supposedly the majority, is, you know, items that communicate by transmitting emotion to the creature, which would fit under this alien category for us. But I do think that it's one of the most underserved types of sentient magic items. The examples that are in the Dungeon Master's Guides, I have a lot of problems with, and I think in actual plays and in our own games, at least in my experience, it's more showy and much easier as a dungeon master to literally give an item the ability to talk if it's sentient. And what does sentience mean if your item can't really communicate what it's thinking?
I think the most excellent example of an alien magic item, a magic item that cannot speak but has motivations, is the One Ring from Lord of the Rings. In fact, the One Ring might be like the most perfect sentient magic item. And it's so funny that it cannot speak, right? Which, when we think of sentient magic items, I think we think of items that can tell us what they want and communicate and try and persuade the players to do the things that it wants them to do versus what the players want to do. Any scene that the One Ring appears in the movies or the books, has tension. There is always the question in the minds of the audience, what will the ring drive the characters present to do? What will the ring itself try to do? It never possesses a character, right? Like, Sauron never takes over the body of someone who is wearing the ring, or the ring never forces the character to do something the way that Tom Riddle possesses Ginny through the diary. It merely pushes and pulls on the character's innate emotions, fears, and insecurities, and tips them over the edge here and there in some cases, or shoves them over the edge in other cases. It encourages our worst thoughts and silences our innate moral compass and the ability to feel what is right. So if a character could potentially imagine themselves doing harm to a comrade in order to get the ring, but normally they would be stopped from doing so by knowing just outright that murder is wrong. The ring doesn't possess someone and cause them to murder their comrade where, like, they're not aware of their surroundings. They don't black out and murder their comrade. They just, like, shut off all of the human feelings that we could feel that would stop us from committing evil, and let the other like innately evil ideas and feelings within us be the only thing there. And that's what drives the character to action.
I was actually watching Return of the King over the weekend, randomly, and your point really made me think about so many scenes. But, you know, there was one in particular where it's just Frodo, Smeagol, and Sam, like, on a ledge going up, you know, to Mordor before Smeagol takes the two of them to Shelob, and he, like, throws all of the Lumbus bread off the side of the cliff and frames Sam for it. And the reality of, like, Frodo's response is just exactly what you were talking about. It's giving the worst interpretation of their thoughts. It's not completely taking over Frodo. It's not possessing him. And you know, certainly if the ring could possess Frodo, or, you know, if the ring could, like, totally possess, you know, Smeagol, Gollum, then it would be a different story. But instead, Frodo's just worst intentions get him to, you know, finally, after, you know, really months, years of traveling together, dismiss and really lose trust in his forever best friend, Samwise Gamgee. And this is such an intense moment as the audience, because, you know, you've watched so many hours of Lord of the Rings at this point, you know, and this friendship is so important, and seeing him throw it away over some bread is, like, crazy, this crazy development, but it's so believable because you've seen the corruption, you've seen the influence of the ring in every scene, like you're talking about. So to me, that is almost like one of the climaxes of the, you know, development of the ring in Lord of the Rings. It's this really intense moment, and I loved it. And so bringing something like that, you know, with saving throws and with, you know, instructions to your players, tell me what your worst interpretation of this scenario might be. You can really collaborate with your players in, I think, exciting ways to bring a story like this to your table.
So looking at the One Ring, what does it want? Well, it wants to be reunited with Sauron. That's its singular purpose. It's pretty straightforward. It's trying to geographically move itself closer to Sauron, and it cannot take over the bodies of people in order for it to do this purpose. It must be carried there by characters. So what can it do in order to get it closer, get itself closer to Sauron? Well, it can resize itself and fall off of hands at opportune moments in time. So if someone is carrying it who is keeping it away from Sauron, or keeping it for themselves away from Sauron, it can make itself fall off a hand. It can also seemingly bend probability to abandon bearers and make its presence known to other people around it. So Smeagol kept it away from the world for years and years and years and years. And then as soon as somebody appears who could potentially carry the ring back into the world such that Sauron could find it, well, the ring abandons Smeagol and makes sure that Bilbo finds it. And it can also tempt those around it to try and take it by force from the current bearer. So I think a lot of the tension in the scenes that we see the ring appear in happens because we know that the ring is capable of acting on the external world, albeit through these extremely limited means. And the means are actually so limited that I think, importantly, the ring can actually be thwarted. So can the ring be thwarted? The answer is yes. In the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, we see that the ring has a lot more capability to kind of like sow chaos when it's being carried around in a pocket. It has a way of making someone play with it and like fumble around with it and maybe accidentally put it on their own finger. But the ring can be thwarted. Frodo wears the ring on a chain to stop it from doing a lot of its typical shenanigans. And in doing so, severely limits the ring's ability to like rebel against Frodo, who is carrying it.
This is like maybe sounds a little bit like a silly point where oh, like, how do you defeat the One Ring? Oh, you just put it on a necklace. But it's actually way more interesting than that from my perspective, because, you know, Frodo does need to use the ring's abilities. Like, this is a magic item in your game of D&D, potentially, if you're trying to port it over. You know, so the way you get an advantage over this cursed magic item is to wear it as a necklace. But the way you gain its power and gain its benefit is to wear it as a ring, where it's most powerful. And so when Frodo does need to turn invisible to stay alive in certain scenarios, he puts on the ring, takes it off the necklace, and those are the moments of the most tension, when it's corrupting Frodo the most, when it's really engaging in the story at its most powerful. And I think the ability for it to be worn as a necklace just adds to the tension in the moments where it has to be worn as a ring. And kind of creating this back and forth, this interplay of choice, when am I going to give in to my cursed magic item, is, I think, exactly what we want from, you know, our more dangerous alien weapons. Like, when do I have to give in to the threat, to the alluring potential of this cursed magic item? Another place where we may draw inspiration for kind of these alien magic items is from a lot of, like, young kids' animes. I think these things are very present. There's almost this, like, Pokemon-style effect where you can't... In these young animes, I think they often treat the, like, objects and things in their world with a lot of, like, revelry and respect. And there's this beautiful example from one of the billion seasons of Gundam that are out there, where the Gundam, who's, you know, what is its motivation? Well, it's a protective mecha suit, and its motivation is to protect its owner. And how does it do that? Well, in this one particular instance, it knows that the only way to kind of salvage the fight is to self-destruct and initiate its, you know, big explosive self-destruct protocol. And the way that it communicates that to its owner, to the player in your game, if it were ported over, is by opening it up its escape hatch, and the lights of the self-destruct mechanism start to flare off. And it's not saying anything, but it's communicating so much, where the, like, mechanisms of, you know, opening and closing the suit is the thing that does so much communication. You don't always need to talk to communicate, and I think this is a good example, as opposed to the evil example of the One Ring, where its actions, you know, like growing and falling off the sides of the finger, are mechanical things rather than communicative things, but they still communicate a lot without words.
So I think the Sword of Vengeance is actually a very effective example of an alien magic item that has some sentience to it in Dungeons & Dragons. Hilariously, it is not categorized as a sentient magic item in Dungeons & Dragons, but it's a sword that is possessed by a vengeful spirit. And when the bearer of the sword takes damage from an enemy, the bearer can be compelled to attack the enemy that harmed them, to take vengeance on that enemy that harmed them, until that enemy is reduced to 0 hit points, or kind of killed in D&D speak. And I think this is a very successful example of an alien magic item. It wants vengeance. That's its thing. That's what it does. I think that the Moonblade, which is an example of a sentient magic item that wants the advancement of elvenkind but cannot speak, is maybe a little bit of a failed example of this alien sentience, because of what we were talking about before, that its goal is so abstract that without the ability to speak to its user, I think it's really hard for a player to unravel the mystery of what the sword wants without just explicitly telling them what the sword wants. So imagine that you find the Moonblade, but you don't know that it's the Moonblade. You think it's just a really powerful sword, and you are fighting against maybe a wizard who has discovered this great magical secret that could advance elvenkind. Maybe they've discovered nuclear power. and the Moonblade is like, oh, like, we could use this discovery to advance elvenkind. And you're about to, like, strike this wizard dead, because they're also evil, of course. And the Moonblade stops, and it won't let you kill the wizard. without the dungeon master being like, oh, the Moonblade pursues the advancement of elvenkind, and it perceives that the wizard's discovery is important to the advancement of elvenkind. The players are never going to piece that together without you explicitly spelling it out for them. And that's what the problem with these like really abstract goals, especially for items that cannot speak and explain themselves to the players.
I think this is also a good example of showing where the Dungeon Master's Guide falls short on the communication abilities of these magic items. You know, in the description for the Moonblade, it says that it communicates by sending a wave of emotions up to the user's arm. And I think that's like not a very engaging way, because as a dungeon master, I almost feel like I'm basically doing the same thing as having a sentient item that speaks. Because what I'm going to be doing as a dungeon master to describe this to the player is just, you know, talk about what it wants. Like, it sends up an emotion of, you know, feeling fear or feeling happy, and it, you know, wants to continue doing this thing. I don't think there's a lot of room for interpretation there. I think there's a lot less room for interpretation than if there is some mechanical change. And I really like the idea with these alien magic items that you have to engage and interpret. Like, an alien shouldn't be something that just is able to tell you exactly what it wants. That's like the whole point of the movie Arrival. They spend 2 hours trying to interpret something that has a very alien consciousness. That's why we called this category of magic items alien, because we really do want there to be this disconnect, this inability to say exactly what we want. And I think the emotions that the Dungeon Master describes are a little bit too like on the nose. And getting away from that and showing that your magic item is not human and it needs to be interpreted, it needs to do some work as a player to figure out what it wants, is really a better way, or at least a more interesting way, to implement the item from my perspective. I think this is a little bit of a missed opportunity from the Dungeon Master's Guide. It really only gives you one way for the Moonblade to communicate instead of some mechanical means like the One Ring has of, you know, like sliding off someone's finger, which is something that you really have to interpret why it did that and what's going on.
I think the Eye of Vecna is a missed opportunity also to be one of these alien magic items. The Eye of Vecna in previous editions, or at least according to the Dungeons & Dragons wiki, is primarily just a very powerful magic item. It confers true sight to the bearer of the Eye of Vecna, but there is a risk that eventually the player might fail a saving throw, and then they are possessed by Vecna. They just become Vecna. Vecna inhabits their body and is now unleashed once again upon the world. And this would be the equivalent of the One Ring. Like, it's a ring of invisibility, but every time you wear it, you have to make a DC 10 wisdom saving throw so that you're saving most of the time. But if you ever fail, your character just becomes Sauron. they're essentially dead, and the DM takes control of them as like a primary antagonist, and the player is just now Sauron.
That'd be a bit of a tough way to end the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly. it kind of like sucks all the tension. There's tension for the roles, because you think a bad thing might happen if you fail. But if you knew how bad that thing was, you would just never take the risk in the first place. And then once you find out what the consequences, it's too late, right? Like, there's no on-ramp.
Yeah, it would take a very specific kind of table and kind of game, I think, to use that to a good effect, where it's just like, your player now explicitly in the rules of the Eye of Vecna becomes a NPC controlled by the DM. And that just happens after that role. And for some places, that would be really cool. And for some places, that would be really uncool.
Yeah, I could see that not going well, especially if like the player doesn't know.
Exactly.
Share it with the one player, but you don't share it with the party. And if they're cool with it, then that's just the way it goes. But I think this is a thing that you can do at your tables. So say the players find a ring of invisibility, which is an item that exists in Dungeons & Dragons. And the players don't know that it is the One Ring. And they're in town, and the keeper of the inn that they were previously friends with tries to murder one of the characters. I think that the players would probably assume that they were a spy for the antagonist that they were working against. Maybe they're working against like a dragon or an evil king. I don't think that the players would necessarily think that the ring had caused that person to try and kill the bearer of the ring such that they could steal the ring of invisibility from them. But that right there is a hint, right? And then over time, maybe the ring falls off a hand. And over time, the players are starting to realize, oh, this ring wants something and can influence the emotions of those around it. And it's a mystery that the players get to unravel over time. Like, what does the ring want? Where is the ring from? That eventually culminates in a solved mystery. We've talked about mystery games in Dungeons and Dragons, how you can adapt a mystery to Dungeons and Dragons in previous episodes. And your players want to solve mysteries. They don't want to win mysteries. And the way that you let your players solve a mystery is by giving them a bunch of hints. The way that you let your players win a mystery is they cast legend lore on the item and you explain to them the like what the ring is and what it does and what it can do and what it wants and all that stuff. And I just think that's a little bit less climactic.
I fully agree. I think this idea of solving the mystery is really, really engaging. And I do think one of the things that I value most as a dungeon master, you know, is those moments where my players are like thinking about the world and thinking about the things that I've put in front of them when they're engaging with it in a way that is different from just using the abilities on their character sheet. It makes me feel this really great sense of like reward and that I've done something that has, you know, impacted the player's game. You know, they're not just playing a video game like Baldur's Gate where they have a bunch of abilities. They're actually like here because I did something creative and thought about something that they are enjoying. And so using an alien magic item, I think, is the best way to give your players a puzzle to solve with a magic item that they're constantly thinking about the background and why did this magic item get created this way? Who created it? What does it want? What has it been doing? In a way that a sentient magic item that can speak will really never fulfill, because ultimately they'll just ask the magic item, where did you come from? What do you want? And these alien magic items, even if they were asked, they wouldn't have a good way to answer. You know, maybe your awakened magic items refuse to answer these questions because they're not human and they don't have memories of how they were created. But a sapient magic item has the most knowledge of that place. They were bound to an item, or they were put themselves in an item, and they have all of this earthly human characteristics that I think really remove the puzzle. Because instead of a collection of actions that your item takes that you need to interpret, you just get to have conversations. And conversations are cool, but they're not as engaging and interesting to me from the perspective of a magic item. It's more like an NPC, and it's not really what I'm looking for when I'm creating a magic item. So I think for me, these alien magic items are the ones that I like to use in my games the most. They're the most fun and the most engaging for me, whereas some of the other ones I might put in more sparsely.
Exactly. We want to, in as many cases as we can, show and not tell. The less explaining that we can do as the dungeon master, the better. And I think that magic items that communicate through emotion are actually the items that set us up to have to explain to our players the most. So I think they should actually be avoided. I think as a dungeon master, if you wanted to use the One Ring and you wanted to have your characters become more selfish over time, I think that you would just tell the player, you now have this character flaw. And you would send them privately a character flaw that says something along the lines of, you assume that those around you want the valuables that you have in your possession, whether it be food, treasure, or powerful weapons. And you don't tell them that it's the ring that's done this to them. You don't tell them, oh, you're starting to feel more selfish. Because the player's going to be like, what? Like, I don't even know if selfish is an emotion, but paranoid is. I think you give your players character flaws, and you now have this character flaw if you want for them to. It's a role-playing creative prompt, a little bit less of a nerf. The Sword of Vengeance does this really well with mechanics. You now attack this creature until it's reduced to 0 hit points.
That's a great implementation. I really, really love that way of doing things, because then your character is buying in to the character flaw almost explicitly. Because if they don't want to have this character flaw anymore, if they don't think that the character flaw is worth the risk and worth the benefits of the magic item, my experience has been that your players will find a way, usually in the story, but maybe not, to ditch the magic item. Not use it less. And maybe only take it out at the most important times, but keep it on the back burner. But if your player really is excited by this character flaw card that you've given them, then they'll maybe opt in and they'll lean into this flaw that you've given them, and they'll be excited about getting the next flaw or the next level of this flaw. And I've actually found that that is like the most common response to giving your players these little secret notes that are negatively impacting their character. I've been a player in that situation before, where I definitely leaned into it and it killed my character in the end and was this amazing experience. But I've played with characters as well where when I give them a flaw, they want the other players to figure it out because they get to be a part of the mystery and they are now in on a secret with the DM, and players always love that, and they get to like act out this character flaw more and more until the rest of the party realizes that this is not just a small like change that they made. This is caused by something, and then your other player characters get to solve the mystery while your individual that you're collaborating with has, you know, put the mystery in front of them. It's this like intensely collaborative experience that creates a ton of agency. Your player, if they didn't want to do it, they would get rid of the magic item, but because they're excited about it, they've opted in. And we love agency here at Running Off the Rails. It's such an important part of why we play this game.
Absolutely. So just to summarize, the three types of sentient magic items that we identified in this episode are sapient, typically humans that once lived and now their consciousness is trapped within the item. Type 2 is awakened. So these items are speaking and they are intelligent, but they are non-human. And they typically have a very, very narrow goal and are not capable of understanding maybe why that goal is unachievable. Slay evil. Arguably an unachievable goal because of how broad of a concept evil is. But the item is driven to act and act often because of how specific and simple the command is. And then we have type 3 alien, which are all show and no tell. These are items that do things. They are items that have mechanical effects, but they cannot speak and they cannot explain to the players what they want. They are the most mysterious and the most wonder-inducing of the three types that we've outlined because they cannot explain themselves. They have to be solved.
Each of these three categories has pros and cons, and just like anything else we've discussed, each of them is an important tool that you can use to generate a specific experience in your game. If you have a party of 5 people, might be a little bit overwhelming to have 3 sapient magic items alongside the party. But if a couple of them are alien, maybe that gives you a little bit more comfort as a DM to, you know, go big in different directions with all kinds of things. I think the more tools you have for your magic items, the more varied and more exciting you can be with what you give to your players, especially in a large party where everybody's going to want their own cool magic item, and it's better if that's a unique magic item and different from the rest.
Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Until next time, I'm Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Raska.
and thanks for listening to Running Off the Rails. If you enjoyed Running Off the Rails, please like, follow, and review our show on your platform of choice. Please follow our Instagram, Running Off the Rails, for notifications whenever we release a blog post, a new episode, or new content on the DMs Guild. If you prefer a specific type of content, please send us a message on Instagram. The jam you are listening to is Hoist by Andy G. Cohen, and you can find Hoist and more of Cohen's music on the Free Music Archive. You can find links to all of our content at runningofftherails.com or on our Facebook page, Running Off the Rails.